Hello, and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Aval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is Harry Timitras, director of the Cyprus Center at the Peace Research Institute Oslo. Hello, Harry, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you, David.
We are speaking on Tuesday, September 8th, a day after Turkey said it would extend its energy exploration in disputed areas of the Eastern Mediterranean until at least September 25th. As the chase for hydrocarbons in the Eastern Mediterranean has intensified in recent years, Turkey has felt increasingly marginalized as Cyprus claims a sizable exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, while Greek maritime claims reach beyond all of its Aegean and Mediterranean islands, almost to the Turkish coast in some areas. This has driven Ankara to send drill ships and seismic vessels backed by warships into waters claimed by Greece and Cyprus repeatedly, most recently near the Greek island of Kastellorizo, a few miles off the coast of southern Turkey. That move prompted Greece to put its military on high alert and dispatch troops to the island. And today, Turkey and Greece are seen as close to war as they've been in maybe a quarter century. Harry, you must have an interesting perspective on all this, having grown up and studied in Greece, then living and working as an academic in Turkey for a number of years, and now you're based in Western Europe and focusing on the Cyprus issue. What do you see as the best way out of this current predicament? Is it more incumbent, do you think, on Greece or on Turkey to take the first step, or do they both need to step forward in tandem?
Or indeed, step backward and do a back step and take everything into perspective. Look, I think we really need to go 30,000 feet up and look at the broader area beyond Turkey and Greece as such, because unless we do so, the actions of anyone in this particular instance, Turkey, because it seems to be the more active one, would not make sense. What I mean to say is that these are decades-old problems that have come to the surface again, be it because of energy that we can discuss in a moment, be it because of other developments that have made Turkey feel cornered, or indeed international regional developments that afford to those people that think along these lines in Turkey a good quote-unquote opportunity to promote a power projection in the region. I think these are all important parameters of this a broader spectrum of events. But at the very end of the day, I think at the moment we're talking about a proactive Turkey that wishes to give a clear message to the West, the broader security West, if you like, that Turkey is an important middle power, a potentially even more important middle power in the region. Nobody can plan things in the region without Turkey. And that was, I think, a message that Ankara really wanted to give to the West, and is taking advantage of the situation in the region and beyond to promote this. It's about a number of things, but mainly it's about this this power projection, if you like, of Turkey and the message it wishes to convey to the West.
You say that these tensions are decades old. Indeed, Turkey and Greece went to the International Court of Justice about maritime issues twice in the 1970s, which basically resolved nothing. Greece, some years later, ratified the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea and now uses it to assert that its islands allow it to claim just about all of the Aegean. Turkey has not ratified the convention and says that the two states should negotiate one-on-one, while Greece calls for adjudication by an external body such as, again, the International Court of Justice. Turkey, surprise, surprise, does not recognize that court's jurisdiction over these issues. I wonder, which do you see as the better route to resolving Turkey-Greece tensions, assuming Turkey's aggressions and Turkey's power projection, as you say, can be curbed? Direct negotiations, are they the better option, or some third-party adjudication?
I think a combination of all of the above. First of all, let's remember that the 1970s, you correctly say, there was a recourse to The Hague, but it's not really that the two countries went. It was a unilateral recourse by Greece in 1976, asking the International Court of Justice to take measures directly, and then because it felt that Turkey was encroaching upon its sovereignty. And then in 1978, the court reached a decision. Whatever the case, there is a judicial past, but this does not necessarily have to be the basis for what happens in the future. Now, the Law of the Sea Convention is an interesting part of the whole puzzle. And definitely Greece, and to an extent, the Republic of Cyprus, are claiming international law, not only because there's a firm belief, a true belief, if you like, that the law is on their side, but also because the smaller powers, either absolutely or comparatively to Turkey, they feel that international law offers a good shield, if you like, especially vis-a-vis a revisionist Turkey. The Turkish position has always been that primarily these are political disputes with an important legal element, yes, but political disputes, and therefore they should also be resolved politically. Greece stands on the foot of international law, claiming that these are essentially legal disputes that need to be resolved legally and possibly by recourse to the International Court of Justice. The fact that the Law of the Sea Convention has not been signed by Turkey, and indeed has been signed and ratified by Greece and the Republic of Cyprus, should not, I think, in and by itself form an obstacle. In the sense that other countries have also either not signed or ratified it. The United States noticeably has signed but not ratified. Israel has done neither of the two. Mm. And this has not stopped the Republic of Cyprus from reaching a delimitation agreement of its EEZ with Israel, and thankfully not. Not considering it an obstacle. And this has also not been an obstacle for Greece and Israel to promote good relations. So essentially, international law does not put any obstacles in place. If countries had the true willingness, if you like, to solve their bilateral or multilateral disputes in a peaceful way, it's a good guidance, but it's not an absolute prerequisite. In the same breath, I must say that Turkey, although technically has not signed or ratified the Law of the Sea Convention, does abide by a lot of its provisions, and indeed is following some of the things that, for the first time, the Law of the Sea Convention envisages, like a 12-mile territorial sea, which Turkey enforces in the Black Sea. So what I mean to say is that if there is a will, there is a way, and international law provides for a multitude of fora and ways for solving the dispute peacefully. The Law of the Sea Convention itself envisages more than 20 different ways, and that's only an indicative list of for countries to have recourse to, including arbitration, conciliation, various commissions between them. And so again, if the countries had a will, then international law provides for a multitude of tools, and that's not a problem. Turkey, on the other hand, although it says, as I mentioned, that primarily there's a political disputes, as of late in particular, is trying to promote a legal argumentation as well, trying to give a message that despite the primary nature of the disputes as it understands it, it's not saying that there is no vehement legal arsenal on its side, should it be needed. And I think within this, one could understand even the Libya-Turkey Memorandum of Understanding, which, problematic as it might be in the eyes of its critics, still moves within the law, if you like. It was an initiative that followed some legal steps with Turkey claiming that it did what it had to do. It came into an understanding with the lawful government or the recognized government of another state, signed an MOU, and followed the legal steps of submitting it to the United Nations. So I mean to say that despite the primary claims of Turkey on the political nature of the disputes, Turkey is also trying to put forward a legal argumentation in addition to that.
Well, let's say negotiations finally do happen. Top Turkish and Greek officials sit down and talk about all of their disputes, from maritime issues to the Aegean to airspace and so on. What sort of compromises do you see as most likely from either side? Where do you think Turkey and Greece are most willing to give ground to reach a deal? Or maybe you think neither is willing to give much ground.
Right. So, in order to reach a negotiation, I think we should start with dialogue. And it's important to draw a distinction between dialogue and negotiation, because dialogue is not only an important component of the resolution of disputes peacefully, and is not only a choice, but an obligation according to international law and to the statute of the ICJ and the United Nations. But it's also a prerequisite even to reach the point of the negotiations. And at the moment, there is literally not even dialogue between the two countries. So I would start with that. And if there is a positive outcome from the dialogue, which does not produce any...
Dialogue, you mean some form of communication to start with, right?
Exactly. Okay. Meaningful communication where the two sit down on a table and try to have an honest discussion before reaching the point of negotiation, which produces legal results. A dialogue does not. Mm. A dialogue would allow them to put together, to understand each other to start with, talking to each other, understanding where they come from, what are the issues involved. And then when they reach the point of negotiation, already there will have to be established a communication, if you like, hopefully a goodwill between the two sides, but a clear understanding as well of where everyone comes from, where they're trying to go, and using which way. Then negotiation, of course, to be meaningful, requires, I think, compromise. And this is quite an interesting point in the Mediterranean, where compromise is not always understood as a positive thing. Indeed, in the Greek language, and I think to a large extent in the Turkish language, compromise. The first reflect is a bad thing. You give rather than you take. Mm-hmm. And so, if you start from that standpoint, then obviously any negotiation would not bear fruit. Compromise need to be understood as a position that allows everyone to live with. We live with the outcomes of this, and where the results are better than the starting point. And I think this is something that needs to register with not only the political elites and the governments, but this is something that needs to be communicated very clearly by them to their respective publics in order to claim political legitimacy for negotiating and for reaching an outcome. Now, the question is twofold here. A, can the two of them just sit together by themselves, or do they need a facilitation, if you like, by a third party, and what kind of legitimacy would this party have? And the second would be, what kind of issues are to be discussed? Are there any red lines, if you like, or does anything go? Now, traditionally, Turkey has tried, if you study its foreign policy, at least since the beginning of the 70s, one would see that Turkey is always trying to broaden the agenda, to include as many issues as possible, introducing as many negotiating cards as possible, in the belief that in the end it's going to end up with something better than it actually started. And within this logic, I think one can see the various claims that are interconnected, from issues regarding the sovereignty, the sovereign rights of Greece and others in the region, then maritime zones, including territorial seas, continental shelf breadths, exclusive economic zones, airspace, militarization of the island, and so on and so forth. Now, is it possible that this whole list could form part of the agenda? I think it is unlikely. But maximalist positions on the part of everyone involved would probably mean that they end up with a list that would be acceptable to both. At this stage, I think a more likely list would be one that would include most, if not all, of the issues pertaining to maritime zones and perhaps the airspace, but leaving out other problems like sovereignty claims, militarization of the islands claims, issues with the Muslim minority in Western Thrace, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned the possibility of a third party, and until any talks begin between Turkey and Greece. Many are looking to external actors. The United States served as the mediator in years past, keeping Turkey and Greece from war over Cyprus in 1974 and over Emir Kardak in 1996. Now Washington is essentially out of the picture as the Trump administration pulls back from the region. The European Union seems to be taking sort of a good cop, bad cop approach, with French President Emmanuel Macron denouncing Turkey's maritime aggressions and sending naval vessels into the Eastern Mediterranean, and German Chancellor Angela Merkel, currently holding the EU presidency, seeking to broker Turkey-Greece talks. Finally, there's NATO. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg last week announced that he had arranged initial talks between Turkey and Greece, both member states, and then Athens quickly rejected this assertion, and that all fell apart. I wonder, Harry, how you see maybe the EU or US or NATO stepping forward and helping reduce these tensions and bringing the two sides together.
The short answer is hopefully so, but I think it's not. It needs to be qualified otherwise. Turkey has, I think, acted at the moment, taking advantage of the fact that the region and the broader region or the world, in a sense, is changing. You rightly noted the absence of the United States from this whole region. I think that go back to even the previous administration, even during the Obama administration, the United States had started to withdraw from the region, at least compared to its presence in the years before. And certainly during the Trump administration, this has been more pronounced. So in a sense, the absence of the United States from this region created a vacuum, that a power vacuum that circles in Ankara thought was a good opportunity to partially fill. The second reason was that the European Union has been going also through a crisis, if you like, a systemic crisis of input and output. To the critics, it has become more of a Europe of projects rather than a project of Europe. There has been a bit of I hesitate to say rivalry, but perhaps a difference of opinion between a number of the member states on a number of issues. We've seen the Visegrad countries taking a different pace on migration. We've seen, as a result of the pandemic, the so-called Frugal Four having a very different position than the countries of the Mediterranean, the EU of the Mediterranean, and so on and so forth. So in a sense, it's a time where neither the United States nor Europe, or the EU rather, have meaningful leverage over Turkey. And this is less in the case of a number of states like France, for instance, that has near zero leverage over Turkey. Less so in the case of other countries like Germany. But the fact remains that the traditional, so to speak, powerhouses in Washington and Brussels have less of a leverage on Turkey at the moment. And combined with the absence in the Eastern Mediterranean, that creates favorable, quote unquote, circumstances to those that wish to pursue a different agenda. Now, it is true that the EU does not always speak with one voice, or to put it differently, the rivalries within the EU, or at least priorities and interests, do not always converge. And so at the moment, you'll see that that the discussion on possible sanctions in Turkey will be a rather difficult discussion within the European Union, between countries that wish to promote the possibility of sanctions and others that are more careful about that. There is criticism regarding the NATO stance, as you say, to some of the critics. France, for instance, in taking a very clear side on this with one of the two parties involved, did not promote a NATO response, but rather undermined it. That's what the critics say. Mm. NATO itself has tried to be involved in a more meaningful way, responding to critics that it had been either absent or rather lukewarm, and this ended up being done perhaps hastily, to the point of being counterproductive to start with. But I think it affords an opportunity to NATO and other countries to use this crisis in a constructive way in the time to come. But this will require, I think, a thinking outside the box. If the reasons behind the message given, or at least the attempt to give a message to Turkey at the moment, are right, then this might be a message that will resonate in Ankara. If it's understood as a message for the sake of the message, then obviously Ankara would not be expected to comply with this. The situation is perhaps unprecedentedly difficult in the region, because we're talking about also different circumstances, perhaps for the first time otherwise for a very long time. What I mean to say is that on top of the political and economic problems we had, this year the pandemic has put things into a different perspective. It's not only a question of willingness of countries now, but also the ability of these countries to handle issues in this part of the world. It's a combination, again, of the willingness and the ability, because we do have pressing circumstances domestically in a number of countries, and regionally, of course, otherwise. So if countries in the region believe that the international community has the ability and willingness that it used to have to be involved in the region, it might not be the case. And so I think it's in their own interest to take a step back, perhaps take a deep breath and deal with the problems in the region themselves, rather than expecting external involvement that might not come, or if it comes, might not necessarily be what it would be expected to be until now. The European Union's reaction to the day, beyond the Greek-Turkish thing, even in the case of Cyprus last year, has been I think indicative of this dichotomy of opinions within the European Union, and has given those circles in Ankara that look at things this way perhaps more of a free hand to act.
Speaking of that dichotomy of opinions, in an article for Cairo Review last week, analysts Henri Barki and Ellen Leibson argued that, quote, events regarding the new energy resources of the Eastern Mediterranean are moving in favor of the Israel-Greece-Cyprus-Egypt coalition. As of mid-2020, Turkey is the outlier attempting to limit, if not undermine, any new multilateral regional institution, which referred to the recently created East Med Gas Forum. I wonder if you agree with that idea, that the past year or so has played to the advantage of Greece and Cyprus, and that Turkey's posture has lost it some ground, because I feel like with the Libya deal, as you mentioned, the Libya maritime borders deal, the recent Black Sea discovery, which showed Turkey's hydrocarbon capabilities, combined with Turkey's significantly enhanced naval capabilities, with all that, one could argue that Ankara today is in a better position than it was a year or two ago. What's your view on that? Has Turkey lost or gained ground in the Eastern Mediterranean?
You could say that in some respects it did, and in some respects it didn't. I think the question is a broader question, and it has to do with two main things. A lot of the discussion we've had until now has been a political discussion, and sometimes this was the case without any grounding on business or the technical aspects. So one question was, to what extent, even until last year or earlier this year, the energy discussion was pertinent if it was carried out in the terms that we're used to. And I'll come to that in a second. The second thing is what happened with the pandemic, which effectively changed very, very dramatically the situation, both regionally but also globally. What I mean to say then, combining the two, is that sometimes we take things for granted. And we've had a discussion since 2010, the first discoveries of gas in the Eastern Mediterranean. And that discussion and the decisions accordingly were taken basically on the basis of political arguments rather than technical and economic ones. And we've reached a stage even before the pandemic whereby the demand in Europe was not coupled with the supply. Europe was absolutely oversupplied and continues to be so with gas. It's literally flooded with gas coming from various directions. And the price terrain thus became an unprecedentedly low price to rent. So the combination of the two, the oversupply and low gas prices, meant that Eastern Mediterranean gas in its totality, and when with that I include Israel and Egypt with really big, comparatively speaking, findings, could not count on Europe being the destination for this gas. And then the pandemic came, and the pandemic meant that the international demand plummeted absolutely. Indeed, or you know, companies have stopped drilling in the East Mediterranean. It's quite ironic that that nobody's drilling in the East Med but Turkey in the EEZ claimed by the Republic of Cyprus. So obviously this is a political issue, but international and regional realities have changed so much that I think what we're seeing in the East Med now is not about gas. It's about everything but gas, simply because it's not only a question of if there is gas, but what to do with it if it were to be found. So in a sense, the discussion...
Well, let me just ask about that. Yeah. I actually have a question. Please. About that. Yeah, I mean, European gas demand fell 8% from January to May. The International Energy Agency says gas markets are likely to be affected long term. Cyprus has made two gas discoveries, Aphrodite and Calypso fields, but has yet to develop them. The East Med pipeline, expected to cost some $7 billion, seems increasingly unlikely. As you say, ExxonMobil, Italy's Eni, French Total have suspended drilling operations. Egypt is struggling to find buyers. So what about this? Is it possible that Eastern Mediterranean gas doesn't even really have a market, and that kind of all of this is much ado about nothing?
It's much ado, possibly about nothing, but the East Med gas at the moment cannot move forward in the way that it was planned. Mm. So in a sense, you know, Europe, as I say, cannot be the market. There might be a market in Southeast Asia, but that will be dependent on prices. And at the moment, it's the finding size-wise and price-wise would not be conducive to that. Eventually, in a longer term, a discussion could be whether these findings could be utilized for the local market, not even the regional, but the local market, where needs obviously exist for all the countries involved, and if this could promote also cooperation between them. But if we think that Europe is going to be a market for East Med gas, I think we're fairly obsolete in this, because just to give you an example, even if everything fell into place politically and financially, and we started today with the execution of the planning, it would take nearly 10 years. And in those 10 years, we've already reached 2030, and the European Union Green Gas Deal kicks in. Europe's demand will fall by 30% anyway, and by 2050, by at least 50%. So for reasons that have got nothing to do with the political realities in the region, East Med gas, technically speaking, business-wise, would not find in Europe a market.
So Turkey is sort of tilting after windmills in the Eastern Mediterranean then?
No, Turkey, as I said before, it's not about gas. It's about a political projection to me. And Turkey has used the gas very much to make a political assertion, even a military assertion at some point, or a political assertion backed by military means, very much in the way that other countries have used this the energy as a platform to promote their own cooperation on other issues, but Turkey has indeed huge gas needs. Yeah, Turkey is importing most of its energy from abroad, and importantly, a very large percentage of its contracts will be coming up for renewal in the next couple of years. So the Black Sea discovery, although in and by itself is not what the industry would tell you would be a super hot finding, it helps Turkey not so much diversify but negotiate better deals with those that it has to renegotiate. So it's an important finding in a sense, but it's not as if it's going to solve Turkey's energy needs as such. Mm-hmm. Turkey is moving in the East Med in the very same way of that other countries have done, but exactly reversely, in using energy as a platform to promote other priorities, political priorities in the East Med.
And just to return to the question I interrupted as you were answering, do you feel like it succeeded in some way? Has it gained ground in this power projection, in this political effort?
So Turkey believes that the situation at the moment is conducive to it pushing further. I think there is a strategy, a backbone, if you like, to Turkish foreign policy. And Turkey seems to be, being very assertive, but in a sort of prudent way, although this is not immediately apparent. Turkey always opens up negotiating cards step by step. And so it's creating gray zones that then turns into red hot issues. And so Turkey is trying to assert itself in the Eastern Mediterranean, opening up all these fronts in an arch, if you like, of political projection from the Aegean to the East Med to Cyprus to Syria to Libya, eventually wishing to establish itself in a number of terrains, if you like, political terrains in the region. In Libya, it has a foot on the ground, to say the least. In Syria, it has also managed to do so. Now the power projection falls onto Greece and Cyprus in the Eastern Mediterranean through energy. So in a sense, we don't know if it's going to be successful in the end, but Turkey has managed, if you like, to raise some claims in the region that it is backing up with military might, and that's what led us to this situation now that needs to be diffused in realistic ways for everyone involved, because obviously, the point was made by Turkey, if that's what it wanted to do. But now the next step could be rather harsh for anyone, including the possibility of an accident through this military built-up that would really be good for no one.
Just a couple last questions for you, if I could. We spoke earlier of U.S. involvement. Last week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the U.S. would partially lift its arms embargo on Cyprus, opening the way for non-lethal weapons sales. The U.S. put that embargo in place in 1987 to deter an arms race on the island and encourage reunification talks between the Greek Cypriot Republic of Cyprus, an EU member, and the Turkish Republic of Northern Cyprus, recognized only by Turkey. Some saw Pompeo's announcement as meant for Turkey, while others said it was more about prying Cyprus away from Russia. Harry, what's your view of the U.S. partial lifting of the embargo? What does it mean for Cyprus, and how might it impact the Turkish perspective?
So I think the arms embargo has been inflated a little bit in the region. Yes, it might be the outcome of the realization of the effects of the U.S. absence from the region, and yes, it might very well be a way of enticing Cyprus to or facilitating Cyprus to take a distance from its facilitation of Russian forces in the East Med. I remind the speakers that Cyprus has been extending naval facilities to Russian vessels operating in the East Med in non-military capacity. That is, I mean, it provides supplies to them and docking stations in Cyprus ports. And so the United States has been rather active as of late in trying to court Cyprus into the Western military alliance and taking a distance from Russia. For Russia, on the other hand, militarily speaking, Cyprus might not be as important as it used to be, simply because with Russia having got in Syria what it wanted and the naval presence in the Latakia and Tartus naval bases, it has what it has. But of course, we're talking about a very time-honored, so to speak, relationship between Cyprus and the Republic of Cyprus and Russia that both have cherished at the moment, also to the extent of Russia being understood as an excellent ally in Cyprus vis-a-vis the Cyprus issue and the Security Council resolutions until now. So I think the United States are making an opening, if you like, towards Cyprus. An opening that has to do with both their wish to return to the Eastern Mediterranean and perhaps in making up for the loss of time. Now, until the U.S. elections, I think it might be a little early to talk about next steps. It's obvious that until now, President Trump has enjoyed a very good personal relationship with President Erdogan, and this might be expected to continue after the elections if President Trump gets reelected. If Joe Biden gets elected, I think we're going to see a return to more Euro-Atlanticism. And within this framework, we'll have to see to what extent Turkey would be understood in Washington as playing a central role. And perhaps going back to a more structured foreign policy in Washington, where the State Department might be gaining a little bit back, being more manned than it is at the moment, and a foreign policy that would be going mainly through the State Department. And in the past, to critics, the State Department had prioritized Turkey over others, in particular Greece. So in a sense, it might be a interesting to see where the developments between U.S.-Turkey relations will be going after the election, depending on who gets elected, and what the priorities regarding Euro-Atlanticism will be.
Last question for you. Starting around 2010 or so, observers began asserting that the discovery of gas in the Eastern Mediterranean would drive regional players to cooperate and collaborate, and that the chase for hydrocarbons would finally lead to a resolution for Cyprus that enabled all players to enjoy the windfall. But here we are, a decade later, and Greece and Turkey are on the brink of war. A Cyprus solution seems as far away as it's been in some time. And the gas, as you just explained, might not even have a market. I noticed you co-authored an article in 2014 titled "Gas Can Become the New Lost Opportunity." Is that what's happened? Has gas become the new lost opportunity in the Eastern Mediterranean?
So, interestingly enough, gas discoveries in historically have never helped in the case of pre-existing conflicts. Indeed, they have always accentuated them. Not to appear pessimistic, there could always be a first, but there is no, so to speak, a historical precedent over this. Now, the gas could have been a fantastic opportunity, I think. A real win-win, at least the first that we've come across since 1974, for everyone involved to cooperate on the basis of a good that did not exist in the past, but now was there in hopeful abundance when we had this discussion. The fact remains that, unfortunately, a lot of lost time is the case. The Cyprus issue has been called in a banal way a history of lost opportunities, and I think this might be yet another chapter in the book of lost opportunities. As I said earlier, it was mainly political decisions political considerations that led to the decisions made in the past, and it was politics that informed the debate, and that has unfortunately led to a lot of lost time, in the expectation that time would be working for one or the other, in the expectation that quantities would be found that would render one having an upper hand, if you like. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's got nothing to do with local realities. It has really got to do with international business realities, and I hope it doesn't get any worse. But unfortunately, we seem to have lost an opportunity a few years ago to promote a cooperation on the basis of energy and allow for Cyprus energy to become a catalyst for cooperation on the island, and then beyond that, energy and Cyprus becoming catalysts for cooperation in the broader region.
So it sounds like you're saying it is too late for gas to compel the players towards a resolution.
It's never too late. Still, as I said earlier, there might be the possibility of using gas for local needs for the next few years, maybe a decade or so. And for local needs, I include everyone involved in the region, all littoral countries, if they had the will to cooperate on the basis of this and facilitating a solution to their political problems on the basis of it. So it might not be what it could have been or what it could be of before, but still it's never too late if you have the will to move forward in a spirit of cooperation and realism displayed by everyone.
Mm-hmm. Harry Tsimitras of the Peace Research Institute, Oslo. Thank you so much for your time and insight. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Very good being with you. Thank you.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.